Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Our guest today is Rachel Gonzalez. Rachel is an artist, licensed massage therapist, energy worker, broom maker, and wart cunner, residing in so-called Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Rachel works to share knowledge, skills, and resources to empower her clients to better care for themselves and feel supported through informed touch, plant experience, crafting, and simple spells, all under the moniker Familiar. Rachel, welcome to In Search of Tarot. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm super excited to talk to you. I was telling you before we hit record that, you know, your products are one of the first things that I discovered when I moved to Milwaukee a little over a year ago. I started to see, you know, these magical witchy products kind of popping up in all these shops. And I was like, who is this person? I have to learn more about them. And we've been kind of planning this interview for a little while now. So I'm glad it's worked out. And I'm just very excited to kind of get to know you a little better today.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
So something I've been doing with all my guests this season is kind of asking them to help us root us in your present moment. So, you know, tell us a little bit about who you are, where you are, and let that be sort of very, very distinct to today. You know, who are you and where are you in this present moment today?
Who am I? Well, my name is Rachel, and my pronouns are she, her, and they, them. And I am a artist, a massage therapist. I'm a Reiki master. I'm a broom maker. I'm a wart cunner. I'm an urban homesteader and a cozy enthusiast. I reside in so-called Milwaukee, Wisconsin, native lands of the Ho-Chunk, Menominee, Potawatomi, and Kickapoo nations, along the shores of Lake Michigami, where I have been trying to do a lot of swimming recently because I do like the cold. My whole thing with living here in Milwaukee is I feel like I have everything that I have done in my life up until this point has like kind of led me to this space here, which is a very small and humble and cozy city that's very blue collar. And I feel very much at home here, more so than any of the other places that I have lived. And right now in my work, I am focusing mostly on returning to a regular art practice after a year of renovating my home and creating a home office and studio space. So I've been feeling very disjointed recently with my creative practice and with connecting with my clients, the people who buy my wares and the people who I provide healing services for. And of about 2 weeks ago, I've started working in the space that I've been renovating for the last year. And it feels really good.
Beautiful, beautiful. And so, you know, your works and your, you know, your practice and your offering are very eclectic. Like you touched on, you know, massage therapy, Reiki, herbalism and self-care products, broom making, which I'm very excited to talk to you tonight about, and your visual art, which was an element of your work that I did not even know existed until I started preparing for this interview. And it's incredible. it's incredible. I mean, it's so moody and evocative, and I really, really love it. So I'm excited to talk to you about that too. How do you trace the roots of your journey down this magical path that has winded and pulled in a lot of different threads along the way?
Oh my gosh, that's such a big question. I feel like I have to reach really far back and sort of talk a little bit about my timeline, because I feel like I've lived like 15 different lives in one life. And you know, over the last few decades, there are iterations of myself that I barely even recognize. I'd say that the roots of my magical practice probably started where I grew up in New England. So I'm from Connecticut. I'm from rural Connecticut, not far from New York State. And I spent my summers in the Adirondack Mountains, where my grandfather is from. Mm-hmm. And my parents are both working people. My mom was a homemaker. I grew up extremely religious. We went to church. I went to youth group, and that followed me all the way to my college years, where I attended university in Swedish Covenant University in Chicago, which is how I landed in the Midwest when I was 18, where I studied fine arts. And I'll get to that a little bit later. But so my mother's family is also evangelical. She was raised evangelical, and I think that where she landed specifically in Connecticut with the large Swedish population, she felt very much at home, and a lot of our social lives encircled the church. And I spent a lot of time in the church, and I was deeply devout Christian. Mm-hmm. At the same time that I was deeply devout, I was also a very spooky child. And, you know, I've been genderqueer my entire life, and I didn't have a term for that until recently, because of the lovely young people that are coming out and saying awesome things and teaching me so much about myself in my older years. But my family didn't really know what to do with me, and I really didn't fit in, and I didn't fit in the strict religious environment that I attended church in. And my mom was actually quite a liberally minded person. She had a lot of queer friends, and she raised me with a lot of access to those people. And a lot of them were artists and musicians and dancers. And I feel like if we had a conversation about it, she wouldn't call herself a witch, but I would. Mm-hmm. She's deeply a death worker. Mm-hmm. She sort of seeks people who are in the process of dying in her church community, and she is basically a doula through the process, and she has done that for several of our family members.
I feel like that's pretty unique for an evangelical background.
100%. And, you know, her sister, my aunt, one of my aunts, I have many aunts, but one of my aunts is deep in the church. And I remember her saying things to me when I was a child, like telling my mother that she thought that I was possessed by the devil because I liked to make artwork and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I also I had a really hard time growing up, because I was diagnosed with Tourette's syndrome when I was in the first grade. And I was also diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder and generalized anxiety disorder a little bit later than that. So I really struggled with the strict church environment and traditional public school growing up. And I ended up in special education. But the important part to that is that the church would often do things like give my mother advice about how to basically deal with me and deal with my neurological problems. One of which was like laying me down on a bed of magnets and making me sleep on it for like a year. That didn't do anything.
Wow.
yeah, just like random stuff like that, crystals, herbal remedies, all sorts of stuff that I've come to understand is elements of folk magic, right? Mm-hmm. Which is combining simple prayer with herbs and remedies. And, you know, there's this intertwining of remedy and spirituality. And it was really impactful on me. And as a child, I really gravitated toward ritual. And because I understood that some things were acceptable and other things were not acceptable, I was a very devout religious young person in the church and very committed to the church. And then I was sort of in the broom closet so far as doing rituals out in nature when I was alone. I think also when you have obsessive compulsive disorder, rituals are very comforting, and it took me a really long time. It took me until I was probably an adult to realize that I could harness the power of ritual, the things that I was already, I had the impulse to do because I have obsessive compulsive disorder, and use them to sort of enact change in my life. And that doing things like repeating myself over and over again, tapping things, reciting things, those are all things that I could use to benefit myself and to cultivate a magical practice. And it felt very empowering to sort of kind of turn it on its head like that. Something that I had been taught to hide and mask my entire life became something that was inherently really powerful and really put me where on the path that I am now.
Yeah, I love that. I was wondering if you feel like living with anxiety is part of what drew you to body work at all.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So, part of having Tourette's means having body tics, which, doesn't happen to everyone with Tourette's, but I had an intense amount of pain. My pain threshold is insane because your muscles are constantly tense and you have no control over your body movements. And it's gotten better as I've gotten older. But when I was young, it was so intense that I had to be taught in separate classrooms a lot of the time, because I was so distracting to other kids. But because I was in such intense pain, I became across massage and chiropractic much earlier than I think other people typically encounter chiropractic care. And it was such a profound experience for me to be taken care of in such a way. I was blessed to become an in-home caregiver and live with one of the women that I caregave for, and then visit other women who needed care in their elder years. And then one woman who was the daughter of an artist that I used to apprentice under, she's profoundly disabled, non-communicative, and he needed someone to come and help take care of her. And it was really awesome to see how body workers were also used in her care. And I would witness the way that she would sort of be taken care of by them, and without being able to communicate how she was, it's so hard to describe like how different she was after the session versus before, and how like the longer you work with someone in a caregiving capacity, you sort of have this knowing about whether they're upset or whether they're uncomfortable or in pain, and to see how that took their pain away, it was just like so interesting to me, and I really wanted to learn more about it.
You mentioned earlier that your mom, did you describe her as a homesteader? Is that the word that you used?
I would not describe my mom as a homesteader. It's something sort of specific to myself and my journey with plants and animal husbandry that I've been interested in.
So explain to me what homesteading means. I'm not familiar with that.
So homesteading generally means a lifestyle of self-sufficiency. And generally, I think people think of homesteading in a sense of prepping, like prepper people who have a ton of water and food stored up in their houses, and they have, you know, they know how to hunt and all of that stuff. Urban homesteading, at least in my opinion, I know that not everybody would agree with me, but I think that homesteading in general should just mean that you are trying to be as self-sufficient as possible so that you are able to contribute to your community when shit hits the fan. For example, when 2020 happened and COVID hit, and you know, March 2020, everybody remembers where they were, right? I was here in Milwaukee at the grocery store staring at empty shelves that were always full of food. And for the first time in my life, there was scarcity, right? And I think a lot of people had a real come to Jesus moment about that.
Yeah.
And the way that I was able to help my community during those early days of the pandemic was I was utilizing my Instagram platform to teach people how to preserve the food they had left in the refrigerator. Because I had this knowledge from gardening over the years and like canning knowledge from my mother, where I know how to preserve certain foods so that they stretch longer and they don't just go bad and end up in the garbage and then you have nothing to eat. Mm-hmm. So I was sharing how to make pickled onions and how to make your jalapenos last longer and how to utilize and how to store garlic properly and how to cook it properly and all of those things. I would say that that counts as a lifestyle of self-sufficiency, is learning as much as you can so that you don't have to be as dependent on systems that want to keep you dependent. It could look like learning how to compost so that you don't contribute to the landfills in your area. It could look like learning how to have backyard bees or chickens so that you have ready sugar or protein and you have enough, you have an abundance to share with your community. You know, and it kind of goes, see, the weird thing is I don't really think, it's funny that you asked that question because I really don't think about it because it's evolved again organically with my witchcraft practice, mm-hmm. with my magical practice, because homesteading is like learning the names of plants, how to grow them, how to forage them, how to harvest them, how to dry them, how to preserve them, how to share them, what you can make out of them. Mm-hmm. And witchcraft, if you are a wart hunter like I am, it goes hand in hand with that. So I'm learning about things that nourish me, and I'm also learning about things that can magically benefit me at the same time.
Yeah, just living side by side, really, you know, like that's what I mean, it's funny, as I'm listening to you talk about this, I live a life of a very like curious person, you know, I mean, I mm-hmm. love to learn, I love to read, I love to discover new things, but because of how I was raised, I didn't realize to, or I didn't even think to be inspired by the land, you know, but to mm-hmm. be inspired by the food I was eating or the, you know, yeah. herbs in the garden. I mean, and when I listen to you talk, I mean, it's like, yes, of course, if I'm, you know, like if I'm going to make a cherry pie or if I'm harvesting apples from the backyard, like, why would I not be like, oh, let me, you know, fall down a rabbit hole about apples, just like I would about, you know, physics or whatever, you know?
Oh my gosh. I've always been drawn to apples due to just like a lot of folklore we grew up with poison apples and all that stuff with apples and witchcraft.
Yeah. So on your website, I was reading that after you finished college and had studied massage therapy, that you ended up moving to Mexico City, which turned out to be a very transformative time for you. So we kind of share a little bit about that time in your life.
Oh my gosh, I'd love to. So what happened was I was just freshly married to my partner, and he was invited to take a job in Mexico City. And so 4 months after we were married, we moved to Mexico City so that he could work. And he was working on the airport there that never ended up coming to fruition, which is unfortunate. And that's part of the reason why we ended up moving back to the States. But anyway, so the thing about Mexico City was, you know, I'm a white girl, born and raised in the U.S., you know, moving to Chicago from rural Connecticut in my very like Caucasian bubble that I grew up in was culture shock. And I considered myself an urban person, a city lover after 14 years of living in Chicago. I was like, oh, Mexico City, it'll be great. It'll be awesome. It'll be like, you know, when I used to go to New York growing up. Absolutely not the same. My entire being as I knew it, just, it was like someone had taken me by the ankles and just turned me upside down and shook me out. And I was faced with all of these ideas that I thought I had about myself, about who I was as a person, all of a sudden didn't exist anymore. And I was this anonymous face in a crowd, in a sea. I don't think I knew until that point how much capitalism's a mindfuck, is what I'm trying to say. I only identified myself by my work. And when I moved somewhere where I could not work, I all of a sudden felt like I didn't know who I was anymore. And on top of that, despite trying to study Spanish, Spanish never became easy for me. I'm not very good with languages. I was very isolated and alone. My husband was working all the time. And I was without a job to distract me. And I had my artistic practice, but I didn't have my normal muses. I was making very different artwork before Mexico than after Mexico. And so on my walks around Mexico City, I learned a lot. And one of the things that I did a lot of observation around was the methods of folk healing there. The curanderas, there's all different kinds of curanderas, curanderos. I'm pronouncing that terribly. Sorry. But the methods of folk healing there were really interesting to me, because what they did was they combined all of the things that I was doing under separate umbrellas under one roof. And it had literally never occurred to me that that was a possibility. I was, you know, because I was working as a medical massage therapist, it was a very clinical environment and a lot of anatomy and a lot of soap noting. And I was wearing scrubs and Crocs and talking with doctors all day. And it was a very stern environment where it was all professionalism. And it was all like this very medical, sterile environment. And that was what I was trained in. That was what I went to school to do. And I was very good at it. I was extremely good at it, but it did not make me happy. And I became an energy worker sort of in secret. I went through the process of becoming a Reiki master and I got attuned over the course of a few years. And that was very sacred to me. And it was not something that I ever combined with my my day job, because I didn't feel like that was welcome there. At the same time, I was learning about herbalism, because working with herbs is the only thing that has ever helped my Tourette's. I had a friend years and years and years ago recommend to me, like, oh, have you ever heard about skullcap and nettle and all of these things, when I mentioned that I had a lot of trouble with keeping my body tics under control. And apparently American skullcap, different from Chinese skullcap, it's an herb in the, I believe it's in the mint family, and it's a nervine, and it helps calm down irregular movements, and it helps people who struggle with anxiety. And because it's a nervine, it also helps with digestion, all sorts of things. Anyway, so I had started using that, and it was like, it was mind-blowing to me that I could drink a tea and I would have more benefit from that than any of the medications I had ever, I've been on every medication you could think of for this problem. And none of them worked and gave me horrible side effects. So I became very interested in herbal medicine. I do need to put a qualifier in here. Take your medication. I fully support people taking their medication and finding herbs. If you're interested in herbs, find herbs that will work with your medication instead of replace your medication. So I was studying herbalism with teachers and workshops and attending herbal retreats in Wisconsin and in Illinois and around the Midwest, and learning privately about these things that that were purely for me and my knowledge. I had never even considered the idea of marrying that with my massage practice, or even that they informed one another, until I was living in Mexico City and I got hit with this revelation that I could do all of them. I could do all of them. There's no one is keeping me from doing that. And so I became very interested in how I could get all of those sort of together under one roof and honor this idea of like softening my medical massage practice and making it a little bit less clinical. One of the things that was most inspiring to me about learning about the methods of folk healing down there was they often were not afraid to be quote unquote unprofessional. My training always indicated that I should never ask too many questions, and I should never tell my clients anything about myself. And I found that a lot of folk healers are people who have been through a lot and learned from it and chose to share that information with their community. Mm-hmm. And that resonated with me a lot.
When you were describing your work during the pandemic, of how you were sharing your knowledge, you know, on Instagram about how to preserve these foods and things, it was, you know, really, I mean, you really are like what I think of as a wise woman, or, you know, I mean, you really have.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, you've taken on that role here, and I'm curious, like, how did that begin? Because I would imagine that gaining the trust of the community is a component of that, you know? So how did you kind of begin to take up that place in the community here in Milwaukee?
Oh my gosh, I have no idea. I feel like, especially during the pandemic, you know, I moved here without knowing anyone. I had one friend. So I was sort of starting from scratch. And I did get a job when I first moved here with a place downtown. So I did not have a client base here. I had a couple people who followed me from that job, but I didn't know very many people. And I started my Instagram with like zero followers, not even many friends follow my work, which is mm-hmm. fine. I like to keep my life separate. I think I began to reach people around the time that the Black Lives Matter movements began in Milwaukee, because I saw a role that needed to be filled in the organization here in Milwaukee around the protests that were happening. I noticed that there was an enormous group of people on Instagram who were not on Facebook, and I'm not on Facebook. I try not to use Facebook. It doesn't bring me very much joy, but mm-hmm. they were not aware of the organizing that was happening because of the way that social media keeps things separate. Like if you're an avid TikTok user, you're probably not seeing the Facebook events. Right. Or if you're an avid Instagram user, or if you're an avid Facebook user, you're not. There was a lot of like people who were only using one thing and not cross-checking, or didn't have the right connections. Mm-hmm. And so I saw a like role that needed to be filled in connecting people who needed to know where the protests were happening and when. I started giving them that information and shooting it out across all of the networks so that everyone could reliably come to my page and know everything that was happening that day, that week, that month, and mm-hmm. all of the resources in one place. And I spent a lot of time doing that organization so that the people who were doing the real work in the streets would have bodies there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And yeah. a lot of people were really confused by that because they and when I say people, I say people were confused why I would bring politics into my business. And to that I say, what makes you think the body's not political? Mm-hmm. And I 100% think that anything that is happening to Black bodies, trans bodies, women's bodies is my business as a body worker to ensure that those people are safe. And if I see that there is a gap that needs to be filled, then it is my job to fill that as a body worker and as a healer. And mm-hmm. if you are a healer or a witch working in your community and not taking care of all of the community, then I would encourage you to re-examine how politics can enhance your practice.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Mic drop. Yes. If you enjoy hearing conversations like this one, please consider supporting In Search of Tarot by becoming a member of our Patreon community. There you'll receive weekly mystic missives discussing any number of philosophical, tarological concepts, along with discounts to upcoming classes and workshops, and invitations to attend our monthly tarot hangs on Zoom. The financial support we receive through Patreon is the only way that we're able to pay our incredible guests who join us week after week to share their knowledge and life stories with all of you. We are so appreciative of our existing patrons' generous support, and we invite you to join them at patreon.com/insearchoftarot. So your business is called Familiar. It's such a great name. And I'm assuming that that's kind of indicating to sort of a witch's familiar. Is that kind of the origin of that title?
Yeah. So it's kind of several different things. I thought of the title when I had just moved back from Mexico City and we were living at our family cabin in rural Wisconsin. It's about 2 hours from here. It's land that I take care of, and I'm very privileged to have access to it. And it's where I forage a lot of the things that I make. So we were living up there, and we had our cats, and we had we were just kind of trying to figure out where we were going to go from there. We weren't sure if we were going to go to Milwaukee or if we were going to go back to Chicago or what that was going to look like. And my only companions at the time were my partner and my cats and all of the little lovely woodland creatures that surround the cabin. And I spent a lot of time in the woods talking to them and trying to suss out where should I go from here and figure out like what direction do I want to go in from here. Mm-hmm. And so when I was thinking about naming this business that and I hate these words like business and products, and I just like, I hate that because like really what I've always wanted to be is just someone who lives in a cabin in the woods and people come knock on my door and let me help them.
Right.
But because we live in under capitalism, like this is what we have to do. I have to make products and I have to have social media and like all that shit. But anyway,
I
was trying to come up with a word that would evoke that feeling of the person in the cabin in the woods who you want to go knock on the door and have them make you a cup of tea or give you some soup or show you where the good mushrooms are. Mm. And I thought that familiar was sort of like a word that, you know, everyone sort of associates with witchcraft because of familiars. Mm-hmm. And I have a black cat, so that was very fitting. But I also was thinking about my Spanish language studies and the word familia and feeling, and a word that sort of evoked the idea of family and community. Mm-hmm. And that this would be a space for people to come if they were in need. And whether that be advice on something that you can bring into your self-care practice or receiving body work or receiving energy work or just someone to talk to or someone who can give you a resource that you're looking for. That is what I was trying to sort of evoke under this umbrella name.
I love that. And one of the most incredible things I think that you do is the brooms that you make. I think it's so unique, you know, and but also so iconic for a witch, you know, and so
oh my god, I know.
Yeah, so when I first found your work, I was like, this is amazing, like she actually makes brooms, you know. And and also I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains, so I grew up with crafts, you know, as a big part of my life. And so one of the times, the first time I actually met you in person, I bought your zine booklet about broom making, and it's,
oh lovely,
yeah, it's fantastic. I loved reading it. So I would love if you would just kind of tell us, you know, what it like, how you got into broom making and why they are so special to you, because I also think that the use of a broom in sort of a more like cleansing your space kind of way might be a nice alternative for people that are concerned about you know, harvesting of sage or Palo Santo or other sort of cleansing techniques, but a broom is kind of another way of doing that. So will you just kind of tell us a little bit about brooms?
Oh my gosh, I would love to. And I could talk about this forever. So going back to Mexico, this is another thing, sort of, I feel like I keep like getting off track. My apologies.
No.
Another thing that I experienced in Mexico City was the culture of cleaning that happens there. And every single day, everyone goes out and they sweep their sidewalks and their porches. And people took great pride in keeping public spaces clean, even though it wasn't their job. It was just something culturally that I experienced there that I thought was really beautiful, was making sure that everyone had a freshly swept surface to walk on every day when they went outside of their homes. And I thought that was beautiful. And I noticed something that I thought was really awesome was the street cleaners there, people who are actually hired by the city to clean the streets. They use homemade besoms to sweep the streets. It's this big tree branch, typically, with a bunch of twigs wrapped around it with either duct tape or rope, and it looks like an enormous witch's broom. And they would take those and they would use those to sweep up any litter that was in the streets. And so you see these often grandmotherly looking people walking down the street with their trash can in their apron, carrying these huge witch's brooms everywhere you go.
Wow.
And I thought it was amazing. So when I moved back to the States, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I'm an artist. I make things with my hands. I love basket weaving. I love like sewing, all of that stuff. And I thought to myself, huh, I wonder if I could learn how to do that. So I did a random Google search for learn how to make brooms. And you'll never guess what happened was, the first search result was a broom making class that was going to happen in Chicago the next weekend.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I traveled to sh I was unemployed at the time. I didn't have anything going on, so I got in my car that I just purchased for the first time and scarily drove to Chicago to take this class. I was so anxious because I was like, oh my God, like I don't know what this is going to be like. And it was just like this big thing for me. And it was so much fun. I had not, it had been a long time since I had spent time in community making art with other people. And, I used to do life drawing and stuff like that, but this was totally different. Like, there's something very inherently ancestral about sitting in a circle, making something together and just talking. And there's no space for phones. There's no space for anything except for the gentle thrum of working and quiet conversation and getting to know other people. And it was just like such a wonderful experience. And at the end of the class, I had this handmade broom. And I look at the broom now. I just was looking at it earlier. I still have it. And it looks terrible, but it was such a special thing. And I was like, this is where it's at. Like, I have spent my entire life going to occult stores and new age stores and seeking that next hit that every person who is involved in witchcraft community gets, right? Like, you love going to the witchcraft shop and buying that crystal and buying that smoke wand and buying that print or whatever. Like, you love going there and it feels so good to do a little shopping and buy witchy looking things for your space. But the juice is in making it yourself. It's so juicy to do that. Like, no one was harmed in the process of doing that. You picked up a stick, you took some raw materials, and you made a magical item that's iconic from your own two hands and things you found that were growing out of the ground. And in a time with Amazon and Whole Foods and all of these like businesses over harvesting plants and endangering plants and mindless consumerism, like one of the most amazing things that you can do for your practice is to just make your own magical tools. And once you start doing that, you have the desire to buy them less and less because you feel how imbued with magic they are. So I finished this class and I realized I didn't want to stop making brooms. I wanted to endlessly make brooms. I wanted to get really good at it. I thought that the process itself was so interesting and that I just couldn't stop. I became obsessed with learning more about it because I realized like it's really hard to find information about it. It's this object that every single person has in their home. And you don't know anything about it. No one even knows what the tassel thing is called, broomcorn.
Right.
No one even knows what that material is. You don't know the difference between a besom and a broom. You don't know what the stick is made out of. You don't know why it has the specific shape that it has. And I thought that was really, really interesting. So I started doing a lot of research, and I did find that Wisconsin was at one point early in American history, one of the biggest producers of broom corn. Mm-hmm. And the style of broom making that I learned and that I teach is Appalachian style. Mm-hmm. The person that I learned from is a student of Sunhouse Craft, which is a incredible broom maker in Appalachia. You should definitely check out their work if you're not familiar with them.
Yeah.
So what I like about the style of Appalachian broom making is there's no machinery involved. It's all woven between your hands and your feet. And that feels like a very intimate process. Like there's something about it that feels like knitting a pair of socks or making someone a bone broth. There's something just so sweet about that, that there's no like machinery. You can just have a stick and some scissors and some string, and you can teach anyone how to do it. And then they can clean their homes, which feels very accessible to me. And then the braiding process too is just a really lovely, it's lovely to look at, but it's also lovely to braid. And I've always been really interested in knot magic, which is a form of folk magic where I'm sure, you know, you can tie knots in things and sort of sing prayers into them and use that as a charm. And it's very simple magic, a very simple ritual. And I've always loved very simple rituals. And so when I'm weaving my brooms, I will sort of knot those things into the braid. Mm. And it's all very mundane looking, but it's all very, if I think like when you experience a handmade broom versus one that you've just picked up from Home Depot that's made out of plastic, and you experience what it's like to sweep in different ways. Mm. It's kind of hard to describe until you experience it for yourself, but
They're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful. So I'm keeping my eye on the clock, but I really want to touch on your visual art before I let you go.
Sure.
Because like I said, it's just really beautiful. And I came across your Field Notes series, from what I understand is sort of an ongoing project for you.
Yes.
So I want to kind of talk about that a little bit. And I want to talk about it in relation to a book I'm reading right now, which is David Abrams' Becoming Animal. And he talks in that book about the idea, or kind of points out that, you know, in early human history, before things became written down, there was a different kind of language that was used that was more visual. You know, he points to like ideographs of China or the hieroglyphics of Egypt, and just points to ways that we might engage with nature and with the world in ways that don't separate us through like the written word does. You know, he points out that the alphabet, it kind of creates a veil or a separation between the actual thing that we're trying to sort of talk with or describe and ourselves, you know, and kind of points back in on ourselves, because we have to understand our human written word in a way that maybe, you know, drawing or different things, it's different, you know. So I kind of felt that when I looked at your Field Notes series. I know that's not exactly what you're doing, but when I was describing what, you know, your process, or when I was reading about your process for that series, I was feeling kind of akin to that same idea. So I wonder if that is true, and just, I would love to just hear about that series and how you kind of entered into that.
Well, that sounds amazing. I really need to check out that book. That's that really resonates with me. And not just for the Field Notes series, for a lot of the work that I've made over the years, that connection between people and nature and becoming part of and learning how to become a part of nature and recognize that we are nature and the sort of the mystery and the supernaturalness of that. Yeah, field notes is, I think, one of my favorite things that I do, but it's something that I don't get to do very often because I sort of consider it, it's almost like performance art, and it's also like spatial art because it's not really art that I create in my studio. It's art that is created out in the world. And it involves me being in a space sort of like a, I guess you could call it sort of like plein air painting. But what I would do was I would take my paper and I would take my pencil and I would go out into the woods and I would find a spot and I would sit down and I would interact with the tiny ecosystem there. And I would try to capture it in that specific moment on paper. And then sometimes I would work back into it later, just sort of tidy it up a little bit, but it's meant to be a piece that sort of exists in that moment, that exact moment, and is not really worked through too much after that. But it was inspired by this artist that I love who would frequently go out and draw on, he had this drawing of a quince tree in his yard, and he would draw the quinces on the tree. And then the next day he would go back and draw the quinces on the same piece of paper. And often that meant erasing what he had drawn the day before and working back into it, because anything that is organic is forever changing, and we are forever changing. And so it almost feels like it almost feels like a death meditation, like thinking about decay and how that changes a space and how things move around, and eventually like that space will not be as we experienced it. And it's just very meditative. And it's something that I really like to do to bring me back to my creative practice when I feel like I've just been trying to replicate for too long and be too much in my head about what art should look like, what a painting should look like. In a lot of ways, I feel like art school kind of ruins you because you have all these ideas about like, oh, well, I can't make a painting unless I, you know, figure out what my artist statement is going to be first. And I get really wrapped up in those feelings of feeling not good enough and not like I'm an art, feeling like I'm not an artist, essentially, and feeling a lot of imposter syndrome around that. Doing an active meditation practice like field notes, where I'm out in nature drawing and I'm experiencing the woodland and I'm feeling the air and I'm smelling what I'm drawing, it's all very tactile and very present. And it makes me feel a lot of gratitude for just being in nature, a part of nature, and like the animism of it all, and quietly observing for a little while how alive just a tiny square foot of forest floor can be.
Yeah, it's also, I'm thinking about how a painting or a drawing of, you know, the landscape is kind of like a, it makes it possible for other people to see a hidden connection that's happening between the artist and the, you know, whatever is being drawn, which I've not thought about before, you know, because, you know, if you're an artist and you're sitting there and you're looking at a tree, I can't know how you're feeling or what you're thinking, but when you draw it, I get that. You know, like I get to kind of peek into that. And it's very cool. I've never thought about that. It's very cool, you know?
Yes. I am like religious about my sketchbook practice. And I should share more of that online. I know people really like it when I share some of that stuff because it's very, I don't know, it's very private. And it's just like doodles and stuff. But there's something about when I'm traveling, I really try to work on my sketchbook more so than snap a picture, because I think we're at this point with smartphones constantly having incredible cameras and video making devices in your pocket at all times. It makes us less, I feel like we're desensitized to how beautiful two-dimensional objects can be. And I love photography. And I think that like, obviously that's an art form in and of itself, but when I snap a picture of something, I tend to forget it. But if I draw it, it's cemented in my memory, the feelings of everything around me, because I'm so aware. I was also definitely one of those people who like had to doodle on my pages in school to pay attention, that kind of a thing. So I think that it just really, it's not the same for everybody, but for me, I think it's very calming. And yeah. I'm able to like fully experience a moment instead of just sort of flippantly take a picture and move on. And it feels like, again, it's another one of those, like with broom making, it's such a mundane thing. It's, there's nothing special about it. It's just pen and paper or whatever. And another thing that I really like about the Field Notes project that has been noted to me by, you know, gallery owners that I've talked to, curators I've talked to, is that I think a lot of people in the highbrow art world look down on pencil and paper as being something that's a little bit too lowbrow, like it's not real art. Real art is oil painting or sculpture or something that involves a lot of, like, you know, you need like a warehouse to store it or whatever. Right. And I like reminding myself that, you know, that is not true. Art can be made anywhere with anything. I don't know if you're familiar with Andy Goldsworthy's work.
No.
So he is a spatial artist, or I believe he's still alive. He's the spatial artist who creates art out in nature using what he found in the environment, and it only exists in that space. And he'll sometimes take a picture of it or take a video of himself making it, but then he walks away and it just composts back into the earth. And wow. the things that he makes are incredible. That's sort of my version where I'm at in my life, where I feel like I have the capacity to do something like that, that feels ephemeral, something that's not necessarily like something I'm making for a gallery environment. It's something that I make to remind me of my connection to creative practice and being out in nature and like how that's all intertwined.
The last question that I want to ask you is one that I've been asking all my guests this season, which is a simple question, but a profound question, I think, as well, which is just, what are you in search of in your life right now?
Oh, yeah, that's tough. You know, we're talking about finding meaning in the mundane, and that I feel like is something that has been on my mind a lot recently, just the simpleness of, we've had such a complicated few years, everybody collectively. We've had this big collective experience, this big collective trauma that we're all sort of moving through, and I know everyone is experiencing it in a different way. And I think for me, it's definitely felt more than just physically isolating. I feel like I am seeking to rejoin the community after what's been a rough couple of years. And I'm also seeking to become more a part of the community, not just in my work, but as a person. Again, it's really easy to get wrapped up in work all of the time and to always be working, right? Especially as a small business owner, especially as someone who wears so many hats and does so many things and has so many offerings, that I think I've been examining recently that feeling I had back in Mexico City when I had first arrived there and sort of was like standing around and being like, well, what do I have to offer now that my work is gone? I love my work, and I love being able to do that for other people. But I think that I want to see who I am out in the community as someone who can receive community as well.
Yeah, I think that we have to be so gentle with ourselves right now, because I think that we all know that we need community, and we know that we need to lean into community, you know, but we have been forced out of it for, you know, 2+ years. And I think it's really hard to find it again, you know, like,
oh my gosh, yes.
A lot of us,
the map is so wrong.
Yeah. And we're struggling with it for a lot of reasons. But there's tension there, you know, and I definitely understand what you're saying, because we also feel, well, why am I not in community? What's wrong with me? You know, like, I need to be in community. Yeah. And, you know, so I feel like for myself, like just kind of being gentle with myself about that and being understanding with why I might be struggling with that, you know, and just letting it happen slowly and, you know, naturally, and not trying to kind of hurry myself along with it, because I think we're all just really struggling with that right now, you know?
Yeah, definitely. The Hermit's been coming up for me a lot over the last few years. I don't read tarot very often, but when I do, it's usually involving the Hermit. And I feel like I'm coming out of that cave now, and I'm excited about what the community is going to look like now that we're all sort of in this process of healing. And I've been talking about this I think it's been on my mind because my clients are having this experience as well, of being like, why are things becoming more normal, feeling more normal? Why do I not feel more normal? What's wrong with me? And I definitely have been feeling that as well. I think that everybody has been collectively struggling with how to do things that used to seem so normal, like reaching out to friends, reaching out to family, visiting people, meeting new people, joining organizations, joining clubs, getting off of our phones and into the world. I think that's what I'm trying to say here is I think I've been thinking a lot and seeking how to feel more comfortable with being out in the world in my body again and feeling like acceptance around that, you know?
Yep.
Yeah.
100%. Well, yeah. Rachel, thank you so much for this amazing conversation. This has been beautiful and just wonderful. I want to let you tell everybody who's listening how they can find you, how they can work with you and purchase your products, even though, you know, we have a certain feels about the term, but you know, everything you make is amazing. So I want to let people know, you know, how they can discover you and find you out there in the world.
Thank you. Yeah, I have, I've been working on a restock right now. There are some things back up on my web store, some old regulars that people know and love. And I will be coming out with a couple new things in the next few weeks as they come out of my apothecary. But you can find everything about me on my website, familiarmke.com. And I'm on Instagram at familiar_mke. And I usually do all of my announcing on there. And you can find my Instagram profile is my link tree with links to my web store, my website, my booking info. If you live in the Milwaukee area, or if you're willing to travel, my books are open through the end of the year. And usually if you make an appointment ahead of time, I can definitely get you in. And I take booking 24/7 for healing services. And yeah, I'd love to see anybody who's listened to the podcast. I'd love to hear from anyone. Please send me a DM on Instagram. I'd love to hear from you. And I will hopefully be sharing more brooms soon and information about broom making classes and retreats that I'll be offering in the next year.
Amazing. Thank you for this. Just thank you for spending this time with me and sharing all of this.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I've really appreciated it. Thank you so much.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's birdgerhl_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.